All right, let's jump right in today. We're taking a deep dive into Ezekiel, specifically chapters 29 through 32. This is all about his prophecies against Egypt.
It's fascinating stuff, really. It's like a window into the ancient world. Empires, prophets, you know, the whole drama of faith and power.
I know when people hear ancient prophecies, they might think it's a bit, well, dry. But trust me, this is anything but.
Oh, absolutely. These chapters are full of political intrigue, military clashes, and some seriously profound theological insights.
The first thing that really struck me was the date in Ezekiel 29.1, January 587 BC. That seems a bit out of place, doesn't it? This is before the fall of Jerusalem, right?
You're right, it is. Most folks would expect these prophecies to come after the fall of Jerusalem, you know, like, I told you so, kind of thing.
Right.
But Ezekiel is giving these warnings before the fall directly to the Judean exiles.
So why is that?
Well, they're clinging to this hope that Egypt will save them from Babylon.
I see. So it's more of a, like, don't put all your eggs in one basket kind of message.
Exactly. He's trying to shatter their illusions about Egypt.
Because, let's be honest, relying on Egypt for help, it's like leaning on a broken reed.
Exactly. And that's not just a random phrase. Remember when Judah tried to team up with Egypt against the Assyrians?
Oh, yeah. That did it so well, did it?
Not at all. Isaiah even uses that same image, the broken reed. It perfectly captures Egypt's unreliable nature. Ezekiel is basically saying, hey, guys, remember what happened last time. Learn from history.
And he really doesn't hold back when describing Pharaoh either. I mean, a monster lurking in the Nile, that's some serious imagery.
Isn't it? That crocodile imagery is so powerful. It's not just about Pharaoh's control over the Nile, though.
There's more to it.
Oh, yeah. Think about the crocodile in ancient Egyptian mythology. It's often linked to chaos, you know, a threat to order and stability.
So Pharaoh isn't just a political figure. He represents something much bigger.
Right. It's like this cosmic battle between God and Pharaoh, order versus chaos.
And to make matters worse for Pharaoh, there were actually Jewish mercenaries fighting for Egypt at this time.
I know. Can you believe it? Talk about a conflict of interest.
Right.
And get this. We have actual historical evidence for this. It's the Elephantine Papyri.
Wait, the what?
The Elephantine Papyri. There are these documents found in southern Egypt. They give us this amazing glimpse into the lives of a Jewish military community stationed there.
That's incredible. So we're not just talking about, like, biblical stories here. We have real life accounts to back this up.
Exactly. And the papyri are full of details about the challenges these folks faced, trying to maintain their Jewish identity in a foreign land. They even built a temple to Yahweh.
Whoa, a temple to Yahweh. While serving in the Egyptian army.
Yeah, it raises all sorts of questions about how they reconciled their faith with, you know, being soldiers for Egypt.
Okay, but here's where I got a little confused. In Ezekiel 37.5, it says the Egyptians actually launched a counterattack against the Babylonians. They even interrupted the siege of Jerusalem.
You're right, they did. It does seem like a contradiction, right? I mean, Egypt's supposed to be this broken reed.
Right.
But if we zoom out and look at the bigger picture, that counterattack, it was ultimately unsuccessful.
So it was like a temporary setback, a plot twist.
Exactly. The Babylonians just regrouped and eventually conquered Jerusalem anyway.
Okay, that makes more sense. But speaking of things not going according to plan, Ezekiel's prophecy about Tyre being plundered, well, that didn't exactly happen as he described either, does it?
Nope, not quite. The Babylonian soldiers actually complained about the lack of spoils. Can you imagine? You can almost hear the whispers among the exiles. See? Ezekiel got it wrong.
I bet that really damaged his credibility. Huh?
Absolutely. And probably fueled doubts about his other prophecies, especially the ones about future prosperity for Israel.
So how did Ezekiel respond to that? Did he try to, like, backtrack or explain things away?
Not at all. In Ezekiel 29.17-21, he addresses it head on. God reassures Ezekiel about his role as a prophet and promises that Israel will prosper in the future. The timing and details might not be exactly as expected, though.
Right, right.
It's like saying, trust the process, even when it gets messy.
Yeah, I like that. Now, as we move on to Ezekiel 31, we get this striking image of Egypt being compared to a magnificent cedar tree.
Ah, yes, the cedar tree.
It seems like such a positive symbol, right? What's going on there?
Well, in the ancient Near East, the cedar was a symbol of cosmic power. It represented the world itself, vast, enduring, seemingly invincible.
So is Ezekiel saying that Egypt is this powerful, unstoppable force?
He's setting that up, yes. But remember, this is Ezekiel. He's the master of symbolic language. He's not just praising Egypt's might.
There's a twist coming.
Oh, absolutely. Because even the mightiest cedar
can be felled by God.
You got it. Ezekiel is driving home the point that even the most powerful nations are ultimately subject to God's will. No empire, no matter how influential, can escape his judgment.
It really makes you think about the empires and superpowers of today, doesn't it?
It does, doesn't it? What happens when human ambition and the pursuit of power clash with divine justice? It's a timeless question.
It really is. Now, there's another element in these chapters that really grabbed my attention. All this talk of death in the underworld.
It does get pretty intense, doesn't it? Especially in Ezekiel 32.
It does. What's going on there?
Well, remember, these chapters are full of pronouncements of doom against Egypt. And that focus on death in the underworld, it mirrors that.
Oh, I see. So it's like a literary technique to emphasize the seriousness of the situation.
Exactly. But here's the thing. These chapters mark a turning point in Ezekiel's message.
Really?
Yeah. The theme of death will soon give way to a focus on life and respiration.
So it's not just about destruction. It's setting the stage for something new, something better.
Precisely. And that shift is crucial to understanding Ezekiel's message of both judgment and hope. It's a message that speaks to, you know, anyone who grapples with questions of faith and power and the possibility of renewal.
Wow. Now let's look a bit closer at chapter 32. There's this lamentation against Pharaoh. It's almost like a funeral song.
You noticed that too, huh?
Yeah, and it's strange because, well, Pharaoh wasn't even dead yet.
Right, but that's the power of lamentation. It's not just about predicting Egypt's downfall. It's about more of the loss of its power and prestige.
I see.
It's like saying, look what happens when you defy God. Even the mightiest empires crumble.
A message that's echoed throughout history, really.
Oh, absolutely. And to drive that point home, Ezekiel compares Pharaoh to a lion and a crocodile, both powerful creatures, but ultimately vulnerable to a greater force. He also emphasizes that Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonian king, is God's instrument against Egypt.
So it's not just about Egypt's internal weaknesses. It's about God orchestrating events on a grander scale.
Exactly. He's using earthly powers to accomplish his purposes.
Which brings us back to that theme of misplaced trust.
Yep. The Judean exiles, they're desperate for deliverance, so they put their hope in Egypt's military strength. But as Ezekiel shows us, true hope can only be found in God.
That's a message that transcends time and place.
Absolutely. It reminds us that in a world obsessed with power, true strength lies in aligning ourselves with God's will.
Now, before we wrap up this part of our exploration, let's look at that final message against Egypt in chapter 32, verses 17 32.
All right.
It feels a bit different from the others.
You're right, it does. Here, Ezekiel is really focused on Egypt's military might. He portrays its defeat in terms of death and descent into the underworld. It's a recurring theme, but there's this added layer.
What's up?
He compares Egypt's fate to other fallen empires. Assyria, Elam, Meshech, Tubal.
Oh, wow.
All once powerful nations, now just gone.
You're saying, Egypt, you're not special. This is what happens to all empires that defy God.
Exactly. But there's also this emphasis on honorable burial versus a shameful fate in the underworld.
Right. What's that about?
Well, you see, in the ancient world, how you died determined your afterlife. An honorable burial meant a good place in the underworld. But if you died violently or you were uncircumcised, well, you were relegated to a much less desirable fate.
And by denying Egypt an honorable burial, Ezekiel is saying that their downfall will be total humiliation.
Precisely. He's using this ancient belief to really emphasize the severity of Egypt's judgment. But amidst all this talk of death in the underworld, you can almost feel this. Anticipation for what comes next.
Because this is the turning point, right? From death to life, from judgment to hope.
Exactly. And that's where we'll pick up in our next deep dive.
Can't wait. But let's take a moment to appreciate Ezekiel's artistry here. He's a master storyteller, isn't he? Weaving together history, theology, even ancient beliefs about the afterlife.
Absolutely. He uses vivid imagery, powerful metaphors. It's brilliant. His prophecies continue to resonate with people even today, you know?
They really do. Well, on that note, we'll pause our journey here for now. We'll be back soon to continue exploring Ezekiel's prophecies. We'll uncur those seeds of hope that sprout from the ashes of judgment. Stay tuned.
See you then.
Welcome back. So we left off talking about this shift from judgment to hope. Why is Egypt specifically chosen as the kind of the contrast here?
You know, that's a great question. It all goes back to Egypt's significance for the Israelites, not just historically, but theologically, too. Remember, Egypt was the place of their enslavement.
Right, the Exodus. That's a pretty foundational story for them.
Exactly. So for the Israelites, Egypt represents both oppression and deliverance. It's a reminder of their past, both good and bad.
Okay, so by focusing on Egypt's downfall, Ezekiel isn't just like critiquing the exiles' hope in Egypt, right?
Right.
He's drawing a parallel between their situation and their ancestors' experience.
You got it. It's as if he's saying, look, I freed you from Egypt once, I can do it again.
That's powerful because it taps into their collective memory, their relationship with God. But, I mean, this time, it's not just about a physical escape.
No, it's about a spiritual exodus, a liberation from sin and despair. It's about a transformation of the heart.
This idea of a spiritual exodus really resonates with me. It's that universal desire for freedom. But okay, let's get back to those chapters about restoration. I remember all this talk about a new temple, a reorganized land.
Yes, Ezekiel gives us this incredibly detailed picture of what a restored Jerusalem will look like. A new temple, even more glorious than the last one, which symbolizes God's renewed presence. He outlines a very specific division of the land, too.
It's like a blueprint for a new and improved Israel.
Exactly. It's this vision of a society with God at the center. Justice prevails. People live in harmony.
It sounds perfect. But you said earlier that it wasn't fully realized, right?
Right. The exiles did return to Jerusalem, and they did rebuild the temple. But this full realization of Ezekiel's vision, it remained elusive. But that doesn't take away from its power or significance.
So it's more of a spiritual ideal.
Yeah, a goal. It reminds us that true restoration, it's about more than just buildings.
It's about an internal transformation, a renewal of the relationship between God and his people.
Exactly. And that's something that still resonates with us today. It's about asking ourselves, how can we build a better world? How can we align ourselves with God's vision?
Big questions. And speaking of things we need to address, remember how Ezekiel compared Pharaoh to a crocodile?
Looking in the Nile, how could we forget?
Right. Such a strong image.
There's a lot more to that imagery than meets the eye. You see, the Nile was Egypt's lifeblood. It was their source of fertility and wealth. But in Ezekiel's prophecies, it becomes something else.
It becomes like a symbol of their vulnerability.
Exactly. By controlling the Nile, God controls Egypt's fate. He even describes how he will dry up the Nile, bring famine, humble Egypt's pride.
It's like he's using their source of strength against them.
Right. It reinforces that no earthly power can stand against God's will.
Okay, so we've talked about this turning point, the shift from judgment to hope. It seems like Ezekiel's role changes too.
You're right, it does. Do you remember how he was appointed as a watchman?
Oh yeah, like a lookout, right?
Exactly. But Ezekiel becomes a spiritual watchman. He's warning people about the consequences of their sin, but he's also proclaiming the good news of God's forgiveness and restoration.
So he's not just a doom and gloom prophet anymore.
No, he becomes a herald of hope, a voice pointing towards a future where God restores his people.
It's like a beacon of light, a promise that things can get better.
And that promise is rooted in God's covenant, a covenant that promises judgment and restoration.
It's a good reminder that there's always a way back. Okay, let's talk about that vision of the Valley of Dry Bones. What does that mean in the context of Ezekiel's overall message?
The Valley of Dry Bones. It's one of the most powerful images in the Bible. It's a metaphor for this seemingly impossible task, restoring a nation that's been completely broken.
Breathing life into something lifeless.
Exactly. Through this vision, God shows Ezekiel and the exiles that even when things seem utterly hopeless, he has the power to bring about renewal.
It's like he's saying, don't underestimate me.
Right. And this vision isn't just about physical resurrection. It's about the restoration of hope, the renewal of faith.
It's about spiritual rebirth.
You got it. And that theme of rebirth is so central to Ezekiel's message. It speaks to our capacity for change, for growth, for finding new life.
I'm really starting to understand the depth of these prophecies now.
I'm glad to hear that. Keep asking questions. Keep challenging assumptions. That's how we learn and grow.
I will. But before we move on, I want to talk about Ezekiel himself. We focused on Egypt, on the Israelites. What was his experience during all this?
That's a great question, and one we often overlook. Ezekiel wasn't just, you know, observing these events. He was living through them, experiencing the same anxieties, the same uncertainties as everyone else.
So he's not just preaching from some distant place. He's right there with them.
Exactly. And we see this throughout the book, his visions, his struggles with his calling, the responsibility of delivering God's message, even when it's hard.
It humanizes him, you know.
Absolutely. It reminds us that even the most profound spiritual truths are often rooted in very human experiences.
And those experiences can shape how we understand those truths.
Exactly. Keep that in mind as we go forward. Look not just at what Ezekiel is saying, but why he might be saying it. What's shaped his perspective?
That's good advice. Now, I'm really curious to see how he balances this tension between judgment and hope.
Me too. And that's exactly what we'll explore as we continue our deep dive.
All right, so we're back. And we're finally shifting gears to that more hopeful side of Ezekiel's prophecies. It's like we've come through this dark tunnel, you know, and now there's light.
It really is. What's so interesting is how Ezekiel actually uses this imagery of light and life. It's a direct contrast to all that death and darkness we were just talking about.
Yeah, it got pretty intense there for a bit. I'm ready for some good news.
Well, get ready, because starting in chapter 33, words like live, revive, restore, they take center stage. It's a whole new vocabulary, one that speaks of healing and renewal.
Okay, so it's not just about, like, physically returning from exile.
No, it goes much deeper than that. It's about spiritual revival, a complete transformation of the heart. Ezekiel even talks about God putting a new spirit within his people, a spirit that allows them to truly walk in his ways.
So it's almost like a spiritual rebirth.
That's a great way to put it. And this whole idea of rebirth, it's beautifully depicted in one of Ezekiel's most famous visions, the Valley of Dry Bones.
Oh, yeah. That's the one with all the, like, dead bones coming back to life, right?
It is. It's such a vivid image. Think about it. This valley, totally filled with dry bone, completely lifeless. But then Ezekiel prophesies over them, and the bones start to rattle. They connect. They're covered with flesh.
Well, it sounds intense.
It is. But remember, it's a metaphor. It represents this seemingly impossible task of restoring a nation that's been completely shattered.
Right. Taking something broken and making it whole again.
Exactly. And through this vision, God is showing Ezekiel and the exiles that even when things seem hopeless, he still has the power to bring about renewal. He can breathe new life into even the driest of bones.
It's a powerful message.
It is. And this hope, it goes beyond just the physical restoration of Israel. It's about restoring hope's self. It's about renewing faith and that relationship with God that had been broken.
So speaking of restoration, Ezekiel doesn't just talk about it, right? He gives us these really detailed descriptions of what this restored Jerusalem will look like.
Oh, absolutely. He's like a tour guide taking us through this revitalized city. There's a new temple, even more glorious than the one before, which symbolizes God's presence returning to his people. And there's this carefully planned division of the land showing order and justice.
It sounds incredible. Like a perfect society.
It does. But remember, we talked about how this vision wasn't fully realized.
Right, right.
The exiles did return and they rebuilt the temple. But that ideal society that Ezekiel describes, it stayed out of reach. But like we said before, that doesn't make the vision any less powerful.
So it's more like a guiding principle, something to strive for.
Exactly. It reminds us that true restoration, it's not just about buildings or politics. It's about a change in our hearts. It's about renewing that covenant relationship with God.
And that's something that we can all relate to, you know, even today.
Absolutely. Ezekiel's prophecies make us ask ourselves some tough questions. How can we be part of restoration? How can we be a force for good in our own communities?
Big questions, and important ones too. It reminds me that these ancient texts aren't just about predicting the future. They're about inspiring us to make the present and the future better.
Well said. As we wrap up our deep dive, remember this. The destruction of empires, even ones as powerful as Egypt, isn't the end of the story. God's plan is much bigger than that.
Right. It's a plan of redemption, renewal, and ultimately, hope.
Exactly. Even in judgment, we find those seeds of hope. And those seeds, they can grow into something truly amazing for individuals and for the world.
That's beautiful. It reminds us that even when things are tough, there's always reason to trust in God's faithfulness. He can bring good out of anything.
Couldn't have said it better myself.
Well, that brings our deep dive into Ezekiel's prophecies to a close. What a journey. I feel like I have a much better understanding now.
Me too. It's always fascinating to explore these ancient texts.
And remember, this is just the beginning. There's so much more to discover in Ezekiel and in the Bible as a whole. Keep reading. Keep asking questions. Keep seeking those timeless truths that can speak to you wherever you are on your journey.
Until next time, keep diving deep.